Welcome to the Apologetics.com radio show. We are so glad that you are with us out there. And this is Jeremy Livermore, your host, and I am joined by my co-host here, Dr. Leslie Wickman. She is the executive director for the American Scientific Affiliation, and we are so glad you're with us today here in studio.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. Well, we actually have a great show lined up because we're going to be talking about science and faith over the next few shows that we do together. And you have quite an extensive background in science and understanding the interaction between science and Christianity in particular. And you have a background in engineering as well. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that you are now at Cal Baptist as the associate director of the School of Engineering. Is that correct?
Associate Dean of Engineering.
Yeah. Yes, Associate Dean of Engineering there. And so can you tell us a little bit about your role as the executive director for the American Scientific Affiliation, and maybe a little bit about your work at Cal Baptist as the Associate Dean of Engineering.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here tonight, and the ASA has actually graciously agreed to help sponsor this show, so
great.
I'm really excited about that, too. So the ASA, the American Scientific Affiliation, the website is asa3.org, and it's an organization of Christians in the sciences, and one of the primary goals of the ASA is to promote the dialogue between science and faith, and to kind of bring that dialogue not just to people who are already working in the sciences or in theology or the intersection of the two, but also to the public realm. And to kind of help people understand that science and faith are not in conflict and that they actually go together hand in hand. And so we're really excited about the mission of the ASA and some of the kind of highlighted things that we do are we have an annual conference every summer. We just wrapped one up in Colorado this past July. And we had a record attendance of 370 people, which
wow.
smashed the previous record of 290.
That's great.
So we're really excited about that. And we're looking forward to our conference next July at Gordon College in Boston, Massachusetts. So
wow, great. Next July. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So can anyone go to these conferences? Or
absolutely. Absolutely. Again, the website of the ASA is asa3.org, mm-hmm. and there'll be more information as the time gets a little bit closer. But yeah, it's open to anyone who's interested in hearing people that have spent a lot of time thinking about these issues of science and faith. So, mm-hmm.
And how long has the ASA been around for? It seems like it's a relatively new organization from my research.
Actually, no, it's been around for 76 years.
Wow.
A year ago, we celebrated its 75th anniversary, so started in 1941.
Wow. I thought I saw something. It said it was around, I don't know, in the mid-90s, but maybe I just misunderstood that. So it has a website now, and you have a lot of your resources from past conferences there. You have a lot of history of the ASA probably on the website, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely.
And who, now does it have names of folks who are participants of the ASA, and who are these people? Are they scientists? Are they academics?
Yeah. There's a large percentage of our members who are professors in the sciences at various universities, both Christian and secular. We also have people who are practicing scientists in industry. Mm. One of our the famous people that we refer to often that's a member of the ASA is Francis Collins, mm-hmm. who is the head of the NIH and was also the head of the Human Genome Project. We have a number of people of his caliber that are members and often come and give plenary talks at our meetings. In fact, this last meeting in Colorado, we had Catherine Hayhoe, who is a prominent climate scientist and a Christian, and gave a wonderful plenary on what's happening in the environment and with climate change and whatnot from a Christian perspective.
Hmm.
So we've also had many other scientists. We had the year before last, when the meeting was held at Azusa Pacific here in Southern California, one of our keynotes was Roger Weens, who worked on the Mars Lander project, the Mars rovers. And we've had Bill Newsom from Stanford, who is a prominent neuroscientist. So we've got some pretty heavy hitters who That's are great. Involved in the organization.
Wow. And so if you are a member of the ASA, do you need to be a Christian or a scientist, or could you just be a scientist and not a Christian, or...
Well, that's a great question, Jeremy. We think of ourselves as a big tent, but so when we say that we're a big tent organization, basically what it means is we represent a large number of disciplines, a large number of perspectives. But the one thing that we have in common is an Orthodox Christian faith. And so that's the tie that binds, if you will. And so all of our members sign a statement of faith. And so we are all Christians, but we have various types of membership. We have a regular member who are typically people who are practicing science currently. We have an associate member that is someone who's interested in science and faith, but doesn't necessarily have to be a scientist themselves. We have student memberships. By the way, student memberships are free, so I want to plug that. If you're a student out there and want to sign up with the ASA for a free student membership, that membership will go for 4 years to take you through your undergrad studies, and then you can up it again for graduate school. So... that's the best deal out there.
Wow.
We also have retiree memberships and friends. And in actually, the friend category does not even have to sign the statement of faith. So we do have people that are kind of either followers or friends that maybe don't feel comfortable signing the statement of faith, but they also want to keep up on the conversation.
That's great. So there are a variety of ways to get involved for all types of different people who are interested to greater or lesser extent.
Absolutely.
There's ways to be involved. So that's great.
Right. So in addition to the annual meeting that we have each summer, we also publish a peer-reviewed scholarly journal 4 times a year called Perspectives on Science and the Christian Faith. And people submit articles to that, and they're peer-reviewed. It has a pretty wide circulation, not just to our membership, but also to various libraries and universities around the country.
Oh, that's great.
And internationally, too, for that matter. So that's another one of our kind of crown jewels of what we do. So,
yeah, I'm going to have to get involved in this and become a member. Because,
absolutely.
After getting to know you a little bit and hearing about it, I guess I wish I knew about this organization a long time ago, because I would have joined it at that time. So it's great that you're getting the word out about it, and we appreciate that. And so folks can go to www.asa3.org.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. All right. So and then when I was checking it out earlier this week, I did see a variety of talks that have been provided, MP3 files, videos, PDFs of papers, mm-hmm. right there on the website, free resources, and high quality ones, I have to say. So thank you for coming and sharing about it. And we definitely want to point people to the ASA, because the science-faith dialogue obviously is a hot topic. It always has been, and it probably always will be. So given the fact that Americans seem to think of intelligent design and creationism and young earth issues and old earth issues quite a lot, when considering Christianity and this alleged conflict with science, it's great to have an organization like this that can help clarify things and really set the contours of the discussion, and so people can navigate their way through better without having to resort to one type of position or one type of organization, like a Creation Research Ministries,
right.
or the Discovery Institute, something like that.
Right.
So this organization seems to be more broad brush and help people really understand the whole discussion.
Right, and that's one of the things we kind of pride ourselves on, is the fact that we do have various positions represented. And we are not an advocacy organization like some of the other ones that you mentioned advocate for a specific position. position, particularly on origins. Mm-hmm. And the ASA has, from the beginning, actually represented a variety of views. Mm. And one of the other things that is kind of a hallmark of our discussions is an atmosphere of humility and respect for various positions. And mm-hmm. so we try to maintain that. And again, like I say, the thing that binds us together is our faith in Christ. And so even though we might have different positions and, you know, disagree on certain things, we try to have those discussions with humility and respect for others.
Mm-hmm. And so as executive director, what is your role there and how long have you been doing that?
I've been the executive director for about a year and a half. And we, you know, obviously the things that I've mentioned already are part of what we do, the annual meeting and coordinating all those details and working with the local committees. Each year we have a committee of people at the local site where we're going to hold it that help with organizing the program and the field trips and the housing arrangements and all that sort of thing. And then the other thing that we've really been doing very actively over the last year and a half that I haven't mentioned so far is what we're calling a local chapters campaign. And that is basically going around the country and meeting with people in their local communities to either energize an existing chapter of the ASA or start new ones. Mm. And that's been really fruitful, and it's been really exciting because, you know, the people come to the annual meeting and they get really energized. I know that's what happened to me. The first meeting I attended was back in 2000. And I remember coming home from that meeting on a high, you know, just really going, man, this is so great. It's a place where I can talk about science and faith with people who have similar interests. And a lot of times, scientists don't necessarily feel like they can talk about science in the church. And oftentimes, Christians who are scientists don't feel like they can necessarily talk about their faith very openly at work. And so the ASA provides this kind of third space, if you will, where that conversation can happen. And like I said, after my first annual meeting, I was like just so excited about finding this place. And we've heard that story over and over again where people kind of breathe a deep sigh of relief and they kind of feel like they've come home. Yeah. And so the local chapter enables that kind of high to be carried through the year, because then you can meet with like-minded people who want to have that discussion on a more regular basis in your own community.
Yeah.
And so that's been really exciting. We've been traveling around the country and probably started about, I think, somewhere in the vicinity of 6 new chapters this year.
Wow.
In various places. And actually our Canadian affiliate, the CSCA, Canadian Scientific and Christian Affiliation, is our sister organization in Canada, and they've also been starting local chapters over the last year and a half or 2 years. They've started another 8 chapters there. So,
oh, that's great.
Very exciting. Yeah,
that is great. Yeah, and you know, you're alluding to this idea of this ongoing discussion, and I think that just speaks to this issue that things are not just so black and white,
right?
You know, and there are different positions that a lot of people hold, but there's also a lot of middle ground there where we are on a journey typically to make assertions and follow that up with evidence and discover more and investigate further and talk to people. And so it's just an ongoing continued research project to figure out where we came from, who we are, what we are, you know, what is this world universe we're in. And so it takes time, and usually people spend their lives thinking through some things and navigate through the different positions that are available. And so having that space, as you put it, is so valuable. And I could see the value of this organization. And so I'm excited about it, and I'm so glad to know that it exists out there. And so thank you for sharing about
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And speaking of journeys, you've actually been on a journey a lot yourself. I mean, you've been navigating your own way through this science faith discussion for, it seems like, your whole life, I would think. I mean, you've been through a lot of different career paths, and you've had the career title of educator, executive director, a test astronaut, very rare type of career title, and a rocket scientist, for crying out loud. Leslie, this is quite the resume. So can you share with us a little bit about your journey,
yeah.
your career journey, and your lifelong journey through
absolutely.
The science faith issues? And I think as you share, people would start to realize, like, you know, I've had similar experiences and similar moments mm-hmm. in my life. And maybe you could share some of your highlights of these things, and it would relate to people who have had skepticism concerning Christianity based on their scientific mindset and skepticism towards the Bible based on their love of science, you know, and maybe you can share some things that would resonate with those folks out there.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So for me, my journey did start at a pretty early age. My dad was an engineer and he had a love of astronomy when I was growing up. And so he used to take us outside at night and look through his telescope at the stars and the moon and the planets. And, you know, this started, I mean, really from as far back as I can remember. So I was probably, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old when we first started doing this. And I just remember, you know, thinking how amazing it was. And I think that was really when I first thought that I might be interested in science as a career. Hmm. And so, you know, grew up in a Christian home. And so looking at the stars and the planet and the planets and the moon, it was always with this kind of underlying assumption that God was the source of all this. And so, you know, I didn't really question that too much until I hit junior high school and encountered my first atheistic science teacher in my biology class. And he would go so far as to say, you might as well just leave your faith at the door, because what we're going to talk about in this science class is going to certainly contradict what you've heard at church and Sunday school.
This is junior high.
This is junior high. So wow. I'm what, 12, 13 years old, right? So, you know, so I was just like, I didn't know what to do with that. Because again, you know, for me, it was like, well, if God is who he says he is, as the creator of all this, how can studying what he's created contradict who he is as the creator? It just didn't make sense to me. And so I look back on that, and it was kind of a, you know, it was a difficult time, because it was like, well, you know, how does this fit together? How does this make sense? And so trying to make sense of what was happening at school versus what I was being told at church and Sunday school was, you know, it was pretty jarring for a junior high kid. But I look back on it now and I'm really actually grateful for that encounter, because, you know, it set me on the path at a fairly early age of trying to figure out how faith and science fit together. And so that was kind of just the beginning for me, but it really did plant that seed in my mind of trying to figure it out.
Hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. And jarring is probably a good word, and people can get thrown off by that, especially at that age. So how did you wind up choosing science and engineering as a career after that? What
right.
led you to start thinking that I need to walk this out and play this out a little further to discover God's work in the universe, or was it that you were just so curious about figuring out how it works that you just had to know?
Right. So yeah, I mean, I always had a very curious mind, and I always asked all the why questions. I'm sure my parents got sick and tired of hearing me ask why. I remember conversations in the car that I have with my dad trying to explain something about electricity to me, and I just kept coming back to the same question, is why does it work that way? Anyway, so I've always had a very inquisitive mind, and so I think I was wired for science from the time I was a little kid, and also I got lots of encouragement in school. You know, I was good in math and science, and so my teachers encouraged me to continue. However, when I got to college, I continued taking math and science, but I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with it. And I think at that point, I was still kind of shying away from this whole idea that I hadn't quite figured out yet about how science and faith fit together. And so there's a little bit of me, I think, that was kind of resisting that. And I ended up majoring in political science.
Whoa. And, at least as a science major.
Quote, unquote. Yeah. So definitely a fuzzy science. Yeah, but
it's hard to believe that it actually used the word science right, for that.
Right. So my senior year in undergrad, I did an internship at the State Department in D.C., and this goes back a little while, but I worked at the Soviet desk. And so this was before the fall of the Soviet Union. And I was really interested in international relations and arms control. But I realized during my time there at the State Department that I really needed to get an advanced degree in order to get anywhere in the State Department. And I also realized that it would really be a great move if I had a degree in engineering, because so many of the politicians that I encountered during my internship didn't have a clue how these weapon systems that they were talking about and negotiating over actually worked. Mm-hmm. And so I actually wrote letters to the Secretary of Defense, and at that time it was Caspar Weinberger. And he actually wrote back to me, or one of his assistants did, and you know, he actually encouraged me along those lines. And so from there, I applied to a master's degree program at Stanford in aerospace engineering. And through a series of events that I would call nothing short of miraculous, they admitted me from, you know, just coming out of undergrad with a bachelor's degree in political science.
Wow.
So, you know, they said, oh, well, your GRE scores are really good. But I'll tell you, that master's program sitting alongside people who have already had 4 years of engineering was probably one of the toughest things I've ever done.
I bet, yeah.
But I persevered and got through it. And along the way, actually, I feel like, you know, God was pulling me back into the sciences, you know, kind of saying, you know, this is what I designed you for. This is what your purpose is to work in this. This is how I wired you. This is where you fit in this world, you know. And so from that kind of running away from science to being thrust back into it, in a sense, I started to really pursue in earnest how science and faith fit together, and started reading books by various people who had studied, you know, the connections, and, you know, everyone from Philip Johnson to Hugh Ross to Francis Collins, some of the kind of big names in this science and faith dialogue. And so every time I learned something new, I just saw more and more connections and connectedness between science and faith. And instead of seeing a conflict, I saw this complementarity and how, you know, things in the created world were so incredibly complex and really defied the laws of probability in terms of how intricately put together and synergistically these various systems work together. And so, like I said, at every turn I saw this complexity, and you know, one of the things that the great apologist Alistair McGrath, who I listened to earlier today, he gave a talk actually at our Canadian affiliate earlier today, and one of the things that he likes to say is that Christianity is the best explanation for the big picture of reality and how everything fits together.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, so I started seeing that more and more as time went on, and so this connectedness just affirmed my faith and helped me keep going.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned a couple of those big name scientists who have been influential for you. And I can definitely say the same for me as well. And I think many people look to certain folks who have moved the conversation forward a little bit and represent guides to us. So you've actually been propelled quite far by the influences perhaps that you've had and your own work ethic, because you've gone through the ringer of a career here. You've really stuck it out and worked your butt off, because you have had some pretty significant career highlights, from what I understand. And every time I learn about you, I'm actually more amazed, because I have here a few things that you've been able to be a participant of: a graduate research fellow at NASA Ames up in the San Jose area.
Right.
It's a great little campus. You were designated a corporate astronaut at Lockheed. That's a really awesome title to have. I bet that was a fun experience.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, looking back on my life, there is no way that I could have pulled all these opportunities and adventures together myself, right? And so for me, early on, I learned that the best way to live my life was to walk through the doors that God opened for me. Mm. And so those are a couple of the examples, and, you know, we can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and we really appreciate you coming on with us, Leslie. It's great to have you here and co-hosting the show with you. And we're looking forward to a lot of future great shows together. And you can actually give us a call and talk to Dr. Wickman if you like. If you have any questions related to this journey that maybe you're on, or you know someone who's on the science faith journey, figuring it all out, you can call us 1-888-888-TALKS. That's 1-888-888-TALKS. We'll be back right after the break.
Save the world, you understand the exemplary feat. You think I'd have to cheat? I made for Dan Brown, deep and furrow brown.
The mission of apologetics.com is to challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe on the radio, on the internet, and now in the Life of the Mind conferences. If you believe in the work that apologetics.com is doing, we encourage you to support us with your prayers and also with your tax-deductible gift, so that this ministry will continue on the air, on the web, and in events near you. Gifts of any amount are appreciated, and it's very simple to participate. Just go to apologetics.com and click donate. It's safe and secure. Or you can send your check or money order to apologetics.com, 1900 Southwestern Avenue, San Pedro, California, 90732. Thank you for supporting apologetics.com.
All right, let's get back to the apologetics.com radio show.
Okay, so we're back, and we were talking about my NASA career.
Yeah, so you actually are one person, the one person I do know that actually worked at NASA, and that's quite cool, because most people don't know anybody that works at NASA. And speaking of NASA, the Cassini satellite just crashed into Saturn earlier today or yesterday.
Yeah.
Wow, I can't even believe that we had a satellite in around Saturn. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's just, it really is amazing the things that we've been able to do, you know, and how fast technology is, the pace of new technological developments is just accelerating.
Yeah. So can you highlight a few things of your experience there at NASA that you would like to share? Because
yeah,
a lot of people would love to probably know what happens there.
Absolutely,
what,
yeah.
What was impactful for you?
Right. So my graduate research fellowship that I did at NASA Ames in Northern California was during the time that I was working on my PhD program. And during the course of that program, I was mainly working on spacesuit design for reduced gravity environments, such as what you would have on the moon or on Mars, and doing tests with test subjects that were weighted for what they would weigh on either the moon or Mars, and then running on a treadmill underwater. And we're taking all kinds of physiological data and biomechanics data. And then we were configuring the mass of the spacesuit at various positions relative to the person's own body center of gravity, mm-hmm. To see whether the placing the mass of the spacesuit at different locations would actually increase the amount of energy or decrease the amount of energy that it would take to move around. So, so anyway, it's a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah.
Kind of overlapping with the same time that I was at NASA, I was also working at Lockheed, and I worked on the Hubble Space Telescope program, as well as the International Space Station program. And I was involved in human factors engineering and crew training. So I was working with the astronauts a lot in terms of, you know, making sure that the hardware that we were designing and building for both the Hubble Space Telescope as well as the International Space Station were designed so that astronauts could work with it in space in a zero-G environment, as well as while wearing a real big, bulky spacesuit.
Yeah.
And so during the process of doing that, I ended up getting a lot of astronaut training myself. And at a certain point, the leadership at Lockheed said, you know what, we're just going to designate you as our corporate astronaut because you've gotten all this training. And so they then began talking to NASA about possible opportunities for me to fly, which is very political, by the way, circling back to political science.
Okay, there you go, yeah.
But anyway, so there were some, you know, there were two shuttle accidents that happened in kind of overlapping with this time frame, and Lockheed went through a merger with Martin Marietta, and so things started looking kind of fuzzy. And meanwhile, I was being recruited. This was right after I finished my PhD, and I was being recruited for work on the Bellagio fountains out in Las Vegas, which seems like a pretty big departure from aerospace, but there are actually some similarities with fluid mechanics and dynamics and whatnot. So I did that for a while, about 2.5 years until we got the fountains up and running.
That's awesome.
And I was involved in developing I was involved in the research and development for the technology for the fountain, as well as developing a simulation program that we used to simulate the fountains on the computer before we actually built them. And then we ended up using that same program to essentially program the choreography onto the fountain. So, so that was a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
I remember during the year that it was getting ready to open, we spent a lot of time sitting on the strip in Las Vegas, literally with a computer table in front of us and running segments of the show on the lake with a cyclone fence behind us, separating us from the throngs of visitors to Las Vegas. So
what a fun experience.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It's very interesting.
And there is definitely some existential satisfaction in doing engineering work and then seeing it through the whole way from concept to completion.
Yeah.
There's something about that the human spirit longs for and is satisfied by.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool. In fact, you know, with the tourists that were actually there just watching us do the programming, we got this real-time feedback. I mean, we'd run a segment on the lake. We'd create it on the computer, then send it to the equipment on the lake and run a segment, and the crowd would just go, ooh, ah. And it was like, it was just so cool. You know, it's like, wow, I guess they liked it. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
So it was
that's a good way to program a show.
Yeah, you know,
to
definitely.
Be successful. But the engineering involved, I mean, there's so many variables with that, and just the fluid dynamics and fluid mechanics. I mean, that's a lot of equations, a lot of formulas go into that. And, you know, developing that and designing that is there's a lot of opportunity for failure.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to you for a successful project. That's great.
Well, thanks. I mean, I wasn't the only one involved in it, but it was, you know, it was very satisfying. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I was involved in the, I was really the person that was responsible for developing this simulation program that we used to program it. So that was very satisfying to have that come off as well as it did. They're wow. still using that same system now. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, and this type of career path that you've taken, you know, you're bouncing around a little bit. You mentioned the Hubble Space Telescope and a test crew member for the International Space Station, and then you've gone through quite a lot of different science arenas already. And so I understand you recently wrote a book.
Yeah.
So The God of the Big Bang.
Yeah.
How Modern Science Affirms the Creator. So right. you're taking a lot of your background and you're helping to explain to the world, hey, I think there's something to all of this science that's beyond the superficial level here, just mm-hmm. how things work. There's something behind that.
Absolutely.
So can you tell us why you chose that title and what this book is about?
Yeah. Actually, it was definitely a God thing, how the opportunity for the book came about. I was actually teaching astronomy at Azusa Pacific University a few years back, and there was big news in the astronomy community about possible evidence for gravity waves mm-hmm. in the cosmic microwave background radiation. Mm-hmm. And so the university relations office at Azusa Pacific asked me to talk to some media outlets about this news from a Christian perspective. And so I talked to a few radio hosts and print outlets and whatnot, and they came back and said, would you be able to write an op-ed piece for CNN's, it's their belief blog section of their website? And they basically gave me 24 hours to write it.
Oh my God.
And I was teaching that night. So I got home around 8 p.m. and I started writing. And I had been thinking about this a lot already. So it wasn't just like I kind of whipped something out off the top of my head, but send it in, you know, somewhere between 11 and midnight, I think, that night. And they liked it. So they ran it. And it was kind of interesting because the CNN editor titled it in a way that I never would have done. He said, "Does Big Bang Breakthrough offer proof of God?" And I'm really careful with that word proof because I think there's a lot packed into that word, and both on the faith side and on the science side. And we can talk more about that, but it really gets to the heart of the scientific method, which really doesn't prove things deductively, like we talk about proof generally in an if-then logical manner of proof. The scientific method does not prove in that manner. It builds a case, and it gives us what the best explanation is given the evidence that we have today, but it's inductive in the sense that new evidence can come along and overturn what we think we know. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that happen in scientific history time and time again. And likewise, in the faith arena, you know, faith itself is not proof. There comes a point where in our faith journey, we have to decide, okay, I'm convinced. Mm-hmm. It's not a black and white, airtight case. We are making a step of faith at some point. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that were not the case, and if the case for Christianity could be proven in such a way as to be completely conclusive in a deductive manner, then where does free will come in? So I think this is a really important point. So in any case, the CNN editor titled this, "Does Big Bang Breakthrough Offer Proof of God?" Well, that was enough to get, I think, curiosity of people to the level of sending this piece, just around the world. So it went viral. It had over 500,000 views in less than a week, and 70,000 plus shares on Facebook. I mean, it was surreal the amount of attention that it got. And so I was getting email from all over the world. And in the wake of all that publicity, I got contacted by a Christian book publisher saying, "Can you write a book on this topic in 4 months?"
Oh man!
And so again, you know, but it's a door that God is opening, and so who am I to say I'm not going to walk through it? So I'm like, okay, this is important. Yeah. And what I was able to do is actually kind of capitalize on the fact that I'd been thinking about this and talking about it for quite a bit, quite a long time, you know. Sure. And I had a series of lectures that I'd given at various places, both to my, you know, astronomy classes as well as to churches and variety of other places, that I kind of turned into book chapters.
I see.
Yeah, so anyway, so it's been exciting to see how God's used that.
That's great. So, yeah, I can see how it would just kind of flow out of you at that point, given the materials you've already generated. So I'm wondering, the God of the Big Bang, how modern science affirms the Creator. There's a lot that comes up when people hear the Big Bang. You know, obviously the age of the Earth and how it happened, and whether there was a God involved or there's just natural processes, and there is some vacuum with energy fluctuations and quantum fluctuations. And so when you start introducing God as the Big Banger, you know, obviously you're clarifying, this is my position, and this is what I'm arguing for, that God was behind the Big Bang. So what about modern science points to that?
Right.
I mean, your subtitle, How Modern Science Affirms the Creator.
Sure.
What is it really that you're going after with this book? I mean, you taught astronomy, you worked with NASA, you had experience at Lockheed as a corporate astronaut. What is it about the cosmos that shows us there is a creator?
Well, particularly with reference to the Big Bang, okay? So the Big Bang is one of the most affirmed theories of science. Mm. It's got a growing body of evidence that confirms it, with essentially no evidence so far to falsify it. Okay, so it is one of the best confirmed theories of science to date, and so the theory that was widely accepted before the Big Bang theory started becoming more widely accepted was the steady state theory, which basically said that, as Carl Sagan was famous for saying, the universe is all that is, all that ever was, and all that ever will be. In other words, that the universe has always existed. And if the universe had, in fact, already always existed, then it's self-existent and doesn't require a cause for its existence. However, if there was a beginning to the universe, which the Big Bang theory says that there was, then there had to be a cause for that beginning. If the universe began to exist at a certain point, then it is not self-existent. And if it's not self-existent, it requires a cause. And so that's very much more God-friendly than the steady state theory. You know, Genesis tells us in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Mm-hmm. The universe, the heavens, the earth have not always existed. And now we're seeing that science actually affirms that. So that is really the big point of the book.
Okay.
You know, I touch on some other things as well. The anthropic principle that basically says that there's a long and growing list of universal parameters that have to be finely tuned within a very narrow range of values in order to get life anywhere in the universe. And that there are various people who talk about the anthropic principle. Some of them list a dozen or more parameters on that list. Others list hundreds. And so depending on where you are on that scale, the probabilities of getting all those just right vary widely. But a middle-of-the-road estimate of the probability of getting everything just right to have life anywhere in the universe is on the order of 1 chance in 10 to the 280th power.
Wow.
Yeah, wow is right.
Astronomical figures.
Exactly, literally astronomical figures. In fact, if you think about it, I mean, one way to think about this is if, there are only 10 to the 80th atoms in the universe, estimated 10 to the 80th atoms in the universe. So this number of 1 chance in 10 to the 280th is well beyond that. And if we say, okay, well, maybe we live in a multiverse, maybe there are 10 to the 80th universes or one separate universe for every one of those atoms in our universe, which is unfathomable too. Mm-hmm. But if we were then to say, okay, let's pick the let's randomly try to pick one particular atom out of all those 10 to the 80th universes, those odds are still only one chance in 10 to the 160th power. We're still not even close to the odds of this one chance in 10 to the 280th power. And my friends at Reasons to Believe actually came up with a good analogy for bringing that probability to a level that we can grasp it. And that it's, this is it. So it's like one person buying just one lottery ticket each time they play the lottery and winning on the one ticket they buy each time twice a week, every week for 50 years in a row.
Okay.
So I love that analogy. Yeah. You know, it's like you present that and just say, okay, look, you know, what if you read that story online somewhere that someone had done this? Of course, the lottery hasn't been going for 50 years, but if you read a story like that, what would your first reaction be? And most people will say, well, it has to be rigged. And it's like, yeah, same for the universe. Mm-hmm. It has to be rigged for life. It ain't just going to happen.
Yeah.
And even statisticians will tell you that once probabilities move beyond one chance in 10 to the 50th power, it goes from being statistically improbable to statistically impossible. There are just too many things that have to go exactly right, stacked upon one another.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's another great argument from science. The evidence that we're seeing in science is this amazing fine-tuning in the universe to get life anywhere. And so that's another argument from science that the God explanation is the best one.
Wow. Yeah, that's really great. And when you talk about the idea that the universe is not infinitely old, you know, there's not an eternal past,
right.
Which is kind of a weird thing to think about anyway, that it had to have a beginning. You know, and modern science confirms that. A lot of Christians point to this idea that the Bible has been saying that all the whole time,
right.
You know, and we're just kind of confirming it now, you know. And there's this analogy people often point to that the scientists have been going around this hill discovering what's around them and how to get to the top of the hill. And finally they meander up to the top of the hill and they find a bunch of theologians who've been sitting there for the whole time and saying,
right.
Okay, we've been telling you that this is the way it is. And so finally you figured it out, you know?
Right.
So, there's that. And then there's the second issue of, whether or not the universe is designed for life and engineered for life and created for life, or if it's just something that happened in an arbitrary way and we're kind of an accident and we're stardust and we're just thinking stardust, we're animated stardust, is what some atheist scientists have said in the past. And so, but when you think about all those figures, I mean, one chance in 10 to the 280th power, you said?
Yep.
And that exceeds the probabilistic resources of the entire universe.
Right.
I mean, we don't even have that many opportunities from atoms clashing into each other to generate these options, in which case we can arise in an accidental way. One starts to think that maybe there's something to this, right. This rigging idea, you know. So, yeah, that's pretty powerful in terms of the logic and the reasoning to say, I cannot be a rational person and ignore these two pieces of information. You
right.
know, there's something to that. And as a skeptical person, I need to consider this and I need to consider this idea that, it seems way too unreasonable to think that we are here literally, we as human beings, and that the universe itself is here by accident.
Right, exactly. I mean, you have to say which takes more faith.
Mm.
You know, where does the rational evidence, the body of evidence, lead you? You know, does it take more faith to believe that a God put this all together, or that we somehow defied these incredible odds and just got super lucky?
Yeah.
You know, it boggles the mind. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting, this idea of a multiverse, you know, multiple universes coexisting in time and space. really gained some popularity as kind of a counter argument to this fine tuning argument, to say, well, you know, given enough chances to get everything just right, yeah. Maybe one of the universes will get all the parameters just right for life. But that's kind of stretching the imagination in the sense that, you know, this idea of multiple universes existing is beyond the realm of science. Mm-hmm. We cannot explore outside of our own universe.
Yeah.
And so that it's really more of a philosophical argument. I mean, yeah. Because of the fact it goes beyond the reach of science.
Yeah. Yeah, the multiverse is definitely something that most atheists point to when they're presented with the fine-tuning argument from Christians. And they tend to think that this is their solution to the puzzle. And so, but you're right. You know, if you're a thinking scientist and you are basing your views on the evidence, and the multiverse has no evidence, and it seems like it could not have ever any evidence just because of the nature of such a thing, the multiverse being beyond our universe that we could never know about, then it seems that that position to believe in the multiverse is a not promising one for
the
atheist.
Yeah, there's no way to substantiate it.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Hawking has actually speculated that some of the ripples in the clumping of matter within our universe that we observe may have come from bumping into adjacent universes, but it's sheer speculation.
Sure.
There's just no way to empirically verify that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, for me, because of how my faith has actually grown through what I've learned from science about the complexity and fine-tuning of the universe, I say bring on the multiverse.
Mm.
My God's big enough for the multiverse.
Yeah.
In fact, the creativity of God, to me, is illuminated through science.
Yeah.
So for me, doing science is an act of worship in itself because it magnifies who God is.
Yeah.
And my wonder at who he is and how he created has just expanded exponentially through what I've learned from science. And I quite frankly would be almost surprised if life here on this planet was all God has ever created. And so, I would not be surprised if we get to heaven, or even if somehow, somewhere before heaven, we discover that there is evidence for multiverse.
Yeah.
Like I said, my God's big enough for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty powerful of a thought. You know, most people can't or have not considered a multiverse and God being the creator of so many universes. But you're right. I mean, gosh, if he created this one, why would we think that he's limited to just creating one?
Exactly. You know?
So bring on the multiverse.
Exactly.
Sure, we're not afraid of that if that's where science is pointing to.
Yeah.
You know, we want to be clear, though, that the evidence so far tends to suggest that there's no such thing, or at least we can't know about it.
We can't know, yeah.
So given that, we're kind of left with what we can observe,
yeah,
and what we can experiment on, so to speak. So Leslie, is there anything in your book that you would also like to highlight here, and maybe even speak to the person who is science-minded and, mm-hmm, and really thinks really clearly and critically about belief in God?
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that it enhances your faith, mm-hmm, when you study science and learn of the discoveries. But what about that person who's just skeptical? I mean, we can't go through all of the topics of God of the gaps and thinking through all the problems where science seems to explain away God and address all that. We don't have time for that tonight. But I want to say, is there anything you'd like to say to that person who tends to just say, well, I have to just continue to look at the evidence. I can't think that God is behind all of this.
Well, again, I go back to what Alistair McGrath and others are famous for saying, and that is that, you know, what's the best explanation for the big picture of reality? You know, we go back to some of the fundamental questions. You know, why is there something rather than nothing? Okay, that's one of the fundamental philosophical questions, just that in itself, let alone the fact that that something is orderly, mm-hmm. which is also significant rather than chaotic, that something is also finely tuned to staggering improbabilities. You know, I think we have to look at all the evidence. And the thing that I would say to people in general who are struggling to see the connections between science and faith, first of all, I believe that God has revealed himself through two primary means. One is through his creation, and the other is through his inspired scripture and prophets and miracles, if you will. And the key there is, if God is the author of both of those means of revelation, those two books, as they've been called, those two books of revelation, and then we have to see that they must fit together. And so the key or the trick is figuring out how they fit together. So my encouragement would be to keep studying both of those means of revelation. Keep studying science on the one hand that gets at God's creation, and study theology on the other that gets at God's special revelation through scripture. And study those. I mean, I think one of the things that we've kind of lost is this almost American or Western notion that we can just crack open our Bibles and read from a 21st century Western perspective what was written thousands of years ago in Middle Eastern languages, and get at the real meaning of it. Faithful reading of Scripture takes some hard work. We have to understand the context, the genre, the original intent. And so that hard work needs to be done on both sides, on the science side as well as on the theology side.
And that's perfect, Leslie. Thank you so much for that. And we do need to dig in and dive in, and you've clearly done that with your career. We've been talking with Dr. Leslie Wickman. She is the Executive Director of the American Scientific Affiliation and the Associate Dean of Engineering at California Baptist University. And we are so glad that we had a chance to walk through some of the issues of science and faith tonight. And we'll be discovering more of this as we go and dialoguing about it. So we'd love for you to join us again. This is apologetics.com, KKLA 99.5.